Hello and welcome to the magazine rack on Chris. I'm Mario Cahar, and today I'll be reading from the Sports Illustrated website, SI.com. First up, we have an article by Ryan Phillips, and it's titled, Five Takeaways from the First Weekend of the 2024 NCAA Tournament. The first weekend of this year's NCAA Tournament is in the rearview mirror, and it was a wild ride. The first two rounds of the Big Dance featured upsets, buzzer beaters, close calls, and three overtime games. Zooming back from the action shows many of the top contenders survived and advanced, setting up another excellent weekend of basketball. But before we get there, let's look back at five takeaways. First, it's UConn versus the field. UConn steamrolled its way through the first two rounds of the tournament. The number one overall seed and defending national champs looked the part by dismantling number 16 seed Stetson and hammering number 9 seed Northwestern. The Huskies led the Hatters 52-19 at halftime and were up on the Wildcats 40-18 at the break. In both games, they appeared to take their foot off the gas to cruise through the final 20 minutes. Dan Hurley's team is hitting its stride and is getting contributions from up and down the lineup. Center Donovan Klingon was excellent in the opening weekend. He scored 19 points, grabbed 8 rebounds, and dished out 4 assists in the first round, and then racked up 14 points, 14 rebounds, and 8 blocks against Northwestern. UConn's two all-Big East first-team guards, Tristan Newton and Cam Spencer, have been steady as well. Newton had 20 points, 10 assists, and 3 rebounds in the second round, while Spencer averaged 13 points, 4.5 rebounds, 3.5 assists, and 2 steals over the weekend. The Huskies have barely broken a sweat and look like the best team in the tournament to this point. They're exactly where they need to be as they roll into the Sweet 16 and prepare for a national championship game rematch against San Diego State. Major conferences rule the roost. Of the 16 teams to reach the tournament's second weekend, 14 come from Power 6 conferences. The other two, Gonzaga and San Diego State, who each boast a national title game appearance in the last 3 years. Both programs are college basketball powers and mid-majors in name only. The Big East has 3 teams among the final 16, and its representatives boast a 6-0 record so far. It appears the conference was better than the selection committee reckoned. Somewhere, Rick Pitino was screaming into the void. The ACC has 4 teams in, while the Big Ten, Big 12, and SEC each have 2. Arizona stands alone for the Pac-12, proving that conference isn't quite dead yet. Cinderella left the ball early this year, but that may mean we get a phenomenal second weekend. The competition should be fierce, with a number of top teams still standing. This is only the 5th time since the tournament expanded to 64 teams that all of the number 1 and number 2 seeds have reached the Sweet 16, and it has only happened twice since 1995. 12 of the top 14 games in the NET ratings are still alive, and that should lead to some incredible basketball games. Next, NC State's run is remarkable. Yep, NC State did it again. The Wolfpack completed an incredible stretch of basketball, winning 7 games in 12 days to reach the Sweet 16. On March 9th, they finished the regular season having lost 4 straight games and 7 of 9. They were 17-14, 9-11 in conference, nowhere near the bubble, and head coach Kevin Keats' seat was getting hot. Then something changed. NC State's postseason run began as the number 10 seed in the ACC tournament, which it had to win to reach the Big Dance. And that's just what the Wolfpack did, reeling off 5 wins in 5 days to earn an automatic bid and the number 1 seed in the South region. Then they upset number 6 seed Texas Tech in the first round and survived an overtime battle with number 14 seed Oakland in the second round. NC State will get nearly a full week off and then face number 2 seed Marquette on Friday in Dallas. No one should be counting out the Wolfpack now. Next, put Ken Pomeroy on the selection committee. Ken Pomeroy's metrics are having a moment in this year's tournament. Ken Pom's pre-tournament ratings have been eerily accurate this season, as 12 of his top 13 are in the Sweet 16, and 14 of his top 21 made it. The only outliers were number 35 Clemson and number 58 NC State. The selection committee got heat for some of its decisions and seeding this year. The committee was certainly off on a few things. Duke is the number 4 seed in the South region, while Pomeroy had the Blue Devils as the 8th team overall in his pre-tournament rankings. He looks to have been correct, as they have cruised through the first 2 rounds. Gonzaga was 15th in Pomeroy's metrics, but got a number 5 seed in the Midwest region. Kansas, 22nd on Ken Pom, got the number 4 seed, and the Zags torched the Jayhawks 89-68 in the 2nd round. Now, those are just 2 examples, but overall, Ken Pom's ratings have been right more often than they've been wrong. Hey, maybe it's time to bring Pomeroy in on the selection process. The tournament doesn't need to be fixed. Entering this year's postseason, there was a lot of chatter from those in power concerning ways to fix the NCAA tournament. Several terrible ideas were floated, like expanding the field or eliminating automatic bids for conference champions. All have the same motive, which is cramming more middling Power 6 conference teams into the field. There would be one motivating factor for doing so: greed. Yep, the NCAA's power players would be completely fine with robbing viewers of the magic small conference teams bring just to steer more cash into their own pockets. It's as if they've been detached from real fans for so long they fundamentally don't understand what makes their product special. The best moment of the 2024 tournament so far was Oakland's improbable upset of Kentucky. Watching Jack Gaulke, a bench player from the Horizon League, dropped 32 points and 10 three-pointers on a blue blood squad littered with 5 stars was astonishing. His performance and Oakland's upset win is exactly what March Madness is all about. The only adjustment the NCAA should make to the tournament is giving conference champions a spot in the field of 64. If a team earns an automatic bid, it shouldn't have to slog through a first 4 game in Dayton. Leave those for the last at-large teams to make the tournament. Other than that, leave the best thing in all sports alone. You're listening to the Magazine Rack on Chris. The next article is by Tom Verducci, and it's titled, Shohei Ohtani's Translator Fired Amid Accusations of Theft of Millions of Dollars. The translator and close friend of Los Angeles Dodgers designated hitter Shohei Ohtani, Ipe Mizuhara, has been fired by the team after a Los Angeles Times report said Mizuhara was accused by Ohtani's lawyers of the theft of millions of dollars from Ohtani. According to the report, Ohtani's legal team accused Mizuhara of using Ohtani's funds to place bets with an illegal bookmaker by the name of Matthew Boyer, who is now under federal investigation. In a statement to the Los Angeles Times, the Hollywood law firm Burke Brettler, LLP, said, and I quote, "In the course of responding to recent media inquiries, we discovered that Shohei has been the victim of a massive theft, and we are turning the matter over to the authorities," end quote. A spokesperson for MLB said the league first learned of Mizuhara's betting when contacted by media outlets and has not heard from federal investigators. Mizuhara was with Ohtani as recently as last Wednesday for the first game of the Dodgers' season-opening 2-game series against the San Diego Padres in Seoul, Korea. According to a report from ESPN, Mizuhara, 39 years old, admitted to running up gambling debts on sports other than baseball with the bookmaker, claiming he didn't know the activity was illegal. ESPN reported that Mizuhara first told ESPN on Tuesday that Ohtani wired payments to cover his debts, which ESPN reported surpassed $4.5 million. But on last Wednesday, Mizuhara told ESPN that Ohtani had no knowledge of his gambling debts and had not transferred any money. According to MLB Rule 21, and I quote, "Any player, umpire, or club or league official or employee who places bets with illegal bookmakers or agents for illegal bookmakers shall be subject to such penalty as the commissioner deems appropriate in light of the facts and circumstances of the conduct," end quote. The rule goes on to define an illegal bookmaker as an individual who accepts, places, or handles wagers on sporting events for members of the public as part of a gaming operation that is unlawful in the jurisdiction in which the bets are accepted. California is one of 12 states in which sports betting remains illegal. Though Mizuhara worked exclusively with Ohtani, he also was an employee of the Dodgers. MLB requires that all translators be club employees, given their full access to team facilities. Now that Mizuhara has been fired by the Dodgers and law enforcement authorities are involved in the case, MLB has no urgency to act. More than just a translator, Mizuhara has been an important part of Ohtani's success since before Ohtani joined MLB in 2017. He's also a close confidant and training partner. As Dodgers pitcher Walker Buehler told SI in an Ohtani cover story in the magazine this week, and I quote, "His interpreter is his secret sauce. He does a great job recording data and remembering. I'm sure Shohei does as well, but Ipe monitors and follows. They're both pros." The more severe penalties associated with Rule 21 involve betting on baseball. Those who bet on baseball games not involving their team are declared ineligible for 1 year. Those who place bets on any baseball game in connection with which the bettor has a duty to perform shall be declared permanently ineligible. For example, Pete Rose was found to be in violation of that section of Rule 21, known as Section D, Subsection 2. Baseball Commissioner Rob Manfred has sole discretion on discipline for violations of Rule 21. The last time MLB levied discipline related to Rule 21, Section D, Subsection 3, came in 2015, just 3 months into Manfred's term as commissioner. His office launched an investigation in March of that year after Marlins pitcher Jared Cosart tweeted about betting large, as he put it. Cosart cooperated with the investigation, which found Cosart did not bet on baseball, but did violate the rule. As a result, Manfred fined Cosart an undisclosed sum on April 3, 2015. You're in tune with the Magazine Rack on Chris. Now, here's an article by Rohan Natkarni titled, "NBA Games Have Been Better Since the Scoring Decline." As has been outlined by several people now, the NBA seems to have undergone a not-so-subtle downturn in scoring, roughly since the All-Star break. Tom Haberstroh has been all over this topic in his Substack, as has Ethan Strauss. You may have heard about it on a podcast from Bill Simmons and Ryan Russillo. The NBA even sent Joe DeMars and Monty McCutcheon on Zach Lowe's podcast to discuss the league-wide dip in scoring and whether the NBA itself was responsible. ESPN would later report the league office even sent a memo to teams outlining an increased focus on eliminating foul hunting, which could be the reason for scoring going down. The gist of all this really is simple. Whether the league put its thumb on the scale or not, they almost definitely did, referees are calling fewer fouls, scoring is tightened, and most importantly, in my opinion, the games have gotten a lot better. For exactly how much the foul rate has reduced, I recommend Haberstroh, was broken down in great detail over multiple stories how sharp the decline in the free throw rate is, and some of its effects on the game. The league seems to be trying to distance itself publicly from the idea that they specifically told refs to call fewer fouls. Frankly, I don't personally care whether or not DeMars or Adam Silver or the people who respond to the NBA referee X, formerly known as Twitter, account, want to take credit for the resulting style of play. I just want to say how much I love the current version of the game, and I hope it's the norm going forward. Now, I understand people who are concerned about the league perhaps trying to manipulate scoring. And there's a gambling angle here that I have no interest in diving into. I just think that what we've seen in games since the All-Star break, seemingly the inflection point for the Great Reduction, is how the NBA should be called all the time. Which brings me to the real point of contention here, consistency. What matters to me less are directives from the league. It would be naive to think Silver doesn't have an opinion on the quality of day-to-day games. What's important is that everyone is on the same page about how things will be called, and that they will be called the same way moving forward. And for the most part, teams seem to have adjusted. Are certain players perhaps a little perturbed on a given night with the level of physicality? Well, sure, but many stars are going to complain about calls no matter what. That's part of the gamesmanship of the game. I do think the new level of physicality, obviously very broadly speaking here, has added a little bit of an edge to these last few weeks of the season. The games feel more intense, and it's plausible to see a team win by getting stops. Now, I'm not some get-off-my-lawn, get-rid-of-the-three-point-line fundamentalist, but it's great how sophisticated NBA offenses have become. Teams should be smart about maximizing efficiency every time down the floor. And at the same time, I'm sick of the moments when playing good defense either feels impossible or futile. Do I need an offensive player to get two free throws every time they drive and initiate contact with their shoulder on someone in an otherwise good position? No, I really don't. Again, if this is actually the new normal, well, then it should be celebrated. It's unfair to say scoring became too easy, but playing defense was probably becoming a little too difficult. Is it fair to, in the middle of the season, dramatically change the style of play by allowing more physicality? Maybe not. As long as it continues, though, then at least it will be a level playing field for everybody. In fact, my biggest fear is whoever is in charge of the foul dip pulling a 180. I remember a few years ago when one of the officiating focuses was eliminating some of the bad faith shooting fouls, like jumping backward or sideways into a defender. I reported a piece on it, and while perimeter stoppers such as Mikal Bridges and Joe Ingles liked the new focus, they were worried the league wouldn't stick with it for the whole season. What remains to be seen is if the current free throw reduction continues, both through the playoffs and into next season. Whoever made the decision, though, I applaud you, because the games have improved as a result. You're tuned in to the Magazine Rack on Chris. Next up is a piece by Dan Evans titled, "The Secret Behind Augusta National's Sparkling White Bunkers." Did you know that the sand at the Masters has a story behind it? Part of what makes Augusta National so stunningly beautiful is its pure white sandy bunkers, except they're not the kind of sand you might be used to. I mean, when I think of sand, I think of rocks that are ground and compressed into little granules, right? But that's not the case for the 44 bunkers at Augusta National. They source some of the finest granules in the world from a little town called Spruce Pine in North Carolina. Now, this isn't just your classic beach sand. It's actually a byproduct of a quartz mine. You know, quartz, that stuff that's used to make semiconductors, which in turn is used to make pretty much every single electronic device known to man. And the byproduct of the quartz mining leaves tiny crystal granules, which are used for the sand traps at Augusta National. And so, if you've ever wondered why the quartz is so stunningly beautiful and why those traps almost shimmer when shown on TV, well, now you know. It's because of those tiny little crystals. You're in tune with the Magazine Rack on Chris. Now we have an article by Jacob Stoller titled, Despite Decline, Ovechkin Could Still Break the Great One's Scoring Record. There's no denying that Alex Ovechkin's best days are behind him. At age 38, Ovechkin, the greatest scorer of the modern era, is slowing down. After 18 seasons of being a virtual lock for 40 to 50 goals a year, Ovechkin is on pace for a career-low 24 goals this season, excluding his output from the COVID-shortened 2020-2021 season. Naturally, seeing Ovechkin decline ought to make one wonder if him breaking Gretzky's goal record is as inevitable as it always seemed. But the reality is that Ovechkin's decline and the probability of him breaking the Great One's record are not mutually exclusive. A closer examination of his 19th NHL season reveals that Ovechkin's down year isn't as bad as you might think. It's just a slump, or rather a tale of two seasons. Ovechkin was unrecognizable in the 2023 portion of this season, recording 7 goals in his first 34 games of the year. Or to put that into perspective, his 0.21 goals per game output would equate to a 17-goal season across 82 games. If you followed at the beginning of the year, his puck luck, in terms of shooting percentage, was astronomically low for his career, Capitals coach Spencer Carberry told the Hockey News 2 Mondays ago. Ovechkin, who had a career 12.9 shooting percentage entering the season, was converting on just 5.56% of his shots in his first 34 games this year. You've got to factor a couple of things in, explained Carberry. Our team is a totally different team without the Nick Backstroms or Evgeny Kuznetsovs playing at a high level. Now we're starting to move into the next phase, and he's playing with a lot of young players that are just trying to get themselves acclimated into the National Hockey League, let alone set up the greatest goal scorer in the history of the game, or one of them. Since January the 1st, though, Ovechkin has flipped a switch. The Great 8 has quietly looked closer to his peak self, recording 12 goals in 29 games, which is a 34-goal pace across an 82-game season. That works out to 0.44 goals per game. As Ovechkin approaches his 40s, it would be short-sighted to attribute the first half of the year as a mere outlier. But then again, when you're talking about Ovi's chances of breaking the record, which is all he has to play for at this point, the road remains paved for him to get there, even as his game has declined. Ovechkin needs 54 more goals to surpass Wayne Gretzky, 894, as the NHL's all-time scoring leader. If you operate under the assumption that this contract, which expires at the end of the 2025-26 season, is his last, Ovechkin has up to 180 games to catch up to Gretzky, if he stays healthy. In other words, Ovechkin needs to score at a 25-goal pace from here on out to break that record. Seeing him drop to below a 10% shooting percentage, 8.6, this year, may make you think there's no chance, but this is a common trend among the game's greatest scorers. For example, Gretzky had a 9.2% shooting percentage in his final 3 years. Other snipers like Brett Hull and Jaromir Jagr took a dip in shooting percentage in their final 3 seasons as well. But you know what separates Ovi from everyone else? He fires the puck at the net way more. So here are the NHL top 5 goal scorers of all time. First, as Wayne Gretzky, 894 goals, 3.42% career shots slash GP. Alex Ovechkin, 841 goals, 4.66 career shots slash GP. Gordie Howe, 801 goals, 4.13 career shots slash GP. Jaromir Jagr, 766 goals, 3.25 career shots slash GP. And Brett Hull, 741 goals, 3.84 career shots slash GP. The Caps are also going to make sure they do everything they can to help him break the record. If Ovechkin was on a contending team trying to win a Stanley Cup, he'd probably struggle to get such ideal deployment, be it in zone starts, line mates, and overall ice time. But he's not. Washington isn't making the playoffs this year, which is probably a good thing for the aging Russian sniper's durability. But there's a chance they'll be more competitive next year. Armed with surplus draft capital after being sellers for the last 2 years, Capitals GM Brian McLellan has lots of ammo to bring in a creative passer that Ovechkin needs. Nobody expected Backstrom and Kuznetsov to decline, let alone depart so swiftly, and Ovechkin benefited from those two elite passers more than anyone else. If Ovechkin finishes the second half of this season strong, and the Caps restructure their lineup slightly this offseason, there's no doubt that the greatest goal scorer of the modern era will become the greatest of all time. This is the Magazine Rack on Chris. Finally, we have an article by Kristen Wong titled, Saquon Barkley shares how his daughter accidentally trolled Giants with a savage one-liner. The NFL world shared a wide gamut of reactions after Saquon Barkley signed with the Philadelphia Eagles earlier this month. Some went off on Barkley for joining an NFC East rival. Others praised his prudent choice to secure a financially lucrative deal. But no single reaction was perhaps quite as memorable as that of Barkley's daughter. The running back recently revealed a hilarious anecdote in which his 6-year-old daughter, Jada, inadvertently and savagely roasted his former team, the New York Giants. After telling Jada he was joining the Eagles this year, she responded, "Does that mean we're going to win now?" Ooh. Giants fans had to feel those painfully blunt words cut deep into their hearts. In Barkley's 6-year tenure in New York, the 2-time Pro Bowler enjoyed just one winning season when the Giants went 9-7-1 in 2022. This year marked Barkley's only playoff trip, with the Giants beating the Minnesota Vikings, but then falling to none other than the Eagles in a crushing 38-7 divisional round loss. Having defected to a more recently successful division rival, the ex-Giants back could soon get used to the taste of victory in Philly, as the Eagles boast 5 winning seasons in the last 6 years and booked a trip to the Super Bowl in the 2022-23 postseason. The Giants and Eagles may own the same all-time playoff record at 25-26. But as Barkley's 6-year-old daughter correctly indicated, the Eagles do indeed have the upper hand when it comes to recent history. Out of the mouth of babes, huh? And that'll do it for this installment of the Magazine Rack on Chris. I've been reading from the Sports Illustrated website, SI.com. I'm Mario Cajar. So long till next time.